And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
Hello, it's Icon Art Radio. And I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. In our last show, we discussed the delicate balance that the artist has to face between craftsmanship, virtuosity, and skill, and spontaneity and passion in the work. And somehow the discussion led to the difficulty in teaching this, because if there's anything that that an art student needs to learn, it's this balance between being able to create a structure for the message to move in and filling that structure with life itself, with passion and meaning, and getting the message across.
What came up that was really interesting, I think, is it's kind of the other side of the coin. It's the fact that if you tell someone something that, from your experience, you know they need to know, but you tell it to them before they need it, or before they are interested in it or ready to hear it, it can prejudice them against it. It's not like it primes the pump as much as it gives them an opportunity to hear an important piece of information and file it away in their memory as something that's not applicable or wrong. And then later on, when it does come up and it is the right time for them and they ask that question and someone gives them the same answer a second time, they recognize it as something they've already heard before and they've already rejected it. And so it loses its value. It becomes irrelevant or incorrect long before they have a chance to test it. And that is what creates the challenge for the teacher. And you were saying the other day that a large portion of what you have to do teaching art is kind of unteaching these things that have been shoved down people's throats before they were ready for them, and they end up being inhibited by them instead of enabled by them.
Yeah, it's totally true in the realm of art, because so many students come to me having learned in art classes that they can't do it.
Yeah.
That's what they've learned.
They've learned they can't.
And so it makes me so aware of my role as a teacher, of the teaching is a very refined art. It has to do with being able to get inside the world view and the point of view and what and where the attention is of the student. And once I'm there, then I very carefully choose what information to give them. I don't give them everything I know. And I don't also judge where their position. I just know that if I can click into the way they see things, that spontaneously, because the spontaneity applies that we're talking about, applies as much to teaching as it does to anything else we've been discussing.
Right.
If I can, so the thing with me is not to tell them a bunch of stuff that I know. And this is the trick in teaching, is to get inside of their point of view and what their reality is and how they perceive life. If I can get myself there, then I'll know spontaneously what to say to convey what I know to them.
Yeah.
Which is to me the mastery of really being a teacher with a capital T, is someone who's tuning in to the needs of each student instead of just following a master curriculum. Where, all right, we have to get through this amount of the lesson today so that tomorrow we can start the next thing, regardless of where, you know, of all the differences in the class. And I've been in the, you know, watched your classes in progress, and it's very remarkable how you can have a whole studio full of people, but obviously be tuning in to the needs of each specific student, so that possibly, I haven't observed it to this degree, but I would guess that there are certain exercises that some of your students spend a long time doing, and other students, maybe you deem, you know, well, no, this, they only need to do this for a couple of lessons, and then this other thing is what they need to be working on.
Right, and some of them get the exercises and some don't. Mm-hmm. I inherited my classes from a teacher who basically just taught drawing on the right-hand side of the brain. It's a certain set of exercises. And she kept the whole thing within the confines of learning how to draw. Mm-hmm. And it was more of a school classroom type situation. When I got, when I took over her classes, we all knew I was going to be doing it differently. And I was also going to take people into the full range of visual expression. I didn't realize, though, because I was an artist that found that I had enough kind of this talent that we're talking about that I could actually convey my understanding to people. So I sort of was a natural teacher, and I didn't know it. So, but I started to practice this thing of teaching. But every now and then, because I wasn't a trained teacher, I didn't know how to do it, in quotes, I just was trying to figure out how to convey the knowledge I had, I would sometimes feel like I should fall back on the right way to do it, like the way she used to do it, and give them those exercises, give everybody those same exercises. And as soon as I would start to find myself doing that, the whole thing went completely flat, and it was, my feeling was, anybody can teach them this. Mm-hmm. And it was a complete waste of my time. Mm. But when I stood there in complete innocence, I had to be able to find within myself no kind of pushing and pulling of shoulds and ought tos and how should it be done and like that. When I would, with the knowledge, see, this is that developed vehicle we're talking about. Because I had for 40 years thought about, been involved with, practiced this field, and I didn't think I really had that much knowledge, but it was 40 years of experience. When I would stand there with 40 years of experience behind these eyes and this voice, and I'd look at what they were doing, something would spontaneously come out on the basis of my tuning in to where that person was at. Mm. And then it was a completely different story. This magic started to happen. It was like the person actually learned something, they actually got it. And at the same time, something else got transferred about this process that we're talking about to the student. And that really is the content that I want to deliver to the student, is this skill in action. We're talking about skill in action. We're talking about being able to do anything well and not be somewhere else. To be in present time, living life to it fully, completely, fully in that moment, in that action. So that act is going to be art.
Yeah. Well, we live in this extraordinarily intense myth that our culture and our whole cultural tradition going back many generations just reinforces and hammers into our heads from day one, that somehow you have to think hard before you act. You have to be thinking. If your brow isn't furrowed, then you know you're not really going to accomplish anything. And it's partly, I guess, the sort of puritanical notion that, you know, life is supposed to be difficult and unpleasant, and that's why we're here, is to just work through it and not really enjoy it. And in some cases, some extreme views that enjoying it is intrinsically bad for you. But it's, you know, on a much larger scale, it's just this idea that if you stopped thinking, you'd die. You wouldn't be able to function at all. And here, you know, most of what we've been talking about for the last 30 or so shows is the fact that, number one, we don't really know exactly how we do even the simplest possible things, and number two, we do our best when we're not analyzing and thinking and fiddling around mentally with it, when we're just going with it, when we're in the moment. So it's a wonderful paradox, and it's no wonder that people are confused by it and, you know, raise strange questions about it, and that there's a big misunderstanding going on here.
Well, and what you were saying about conveying this difference to the students, you're conveying it by example and by osmosis.
That's the only way you can, I think.
Yeah. Completely, because
yeah, you have to show it.
So the most important thing getting across cannot be explained. It can only be sensed. Yeah. And this is not a comfortable approach in this culture, as you've pointed out, because there's sort of a need to control, to be in control, and to know in advance how everything's going to go.
Yeah.
And functioning in life is not that way.
Yeah.
So it's a, we have a kind of like schizophrenic sort of really divided way about us in this culture.
Well, one of my best friends many years ago is a rather advanced theoretical mathematician, and we had wonderful conversations because he enjoyed trying to explain advanced math concepts to people who didn't know anything about math, because to him they were just concepts and that didn't require, he felt if he couldn't explain it, it just meant he didn't understand it. It didn't mean that I didn't have enough math. So that was made for interesting conversations. but repeatedly over the years that I knew him, when he was confronted with a really complex mathematical problem and he'd been trying to solve it or see the way it worked, and had been spending perhaps weeks or months on something without being able to quite grasp the essence of it, invariably, whenever he finally came to the solution, it happened when he was not thinking about it. Mm. It never, ever happened when he was thinking about it, to the point where the last few years that we were conversing about these things, that was the only topic of conversation. It was just, where do these things come from? Mm. And they definitely don't come from, you know, mental, focused, you know, intellectual kind of activity.
And yet there's something about the thoughts going through, you know, it's sort of like when you go to bed and you're pondering and struggling over some problem you're having and you can't figure it out, and then you go to sleep. You can often like wake up in the morning and the first thing that comes into your mind is a solution to that problem.
Exactly.
And but perhaps if you hadn't been dwelling
trying
on it,
so hard,
if you hadn't been thinking about it to that degree before you went to bed, do you think the solution would have come to you anyway, even if you
much
hadn't
sooner,
been?
Yeah. I think it's like when you try to remember something. I think about it like this. If I'm trying to remember the name of some actor in a movie I saw, and I sort of glance back into my file storage area and I don't see the name, all I can, literally, you draw a blank. What can you do? You know, there's no crank to turn. There's no button to push. And so what I do now is I figure there's some guy down in the basement and there's like rooms and rooms and rooms full of filing cabinets. And I have just said to him, I need that guy's name. And he said, okay, and he started, you know, rummaging around in these file cabinets. If I keep yelling at him about which name I want, each time I yell at him, he's going to lose his place in the file cabinets and he's going to have to say, yeah, okay, I'm getting it. Don't worry about it. Yes, sir. We'll take care of that as quickly as possible. And then he'll go back to the file cabinets and probably end up having to start all over again. And at some point, if I yell at him long enough and often enough, he's going to completely lose track of the original request, and it's just going to be, you know, some sort of mental experience of me experiencing my own frustration at not having this information. Instead of, place the request. If it requires some rummaging around, it may take 5 minutes, it may take 5 hours, who knows. Sometimes it seems to take days. You know, you're trying to think of something like that that you've forgotten, and 3 days later you're walking down the street, you know, looking at a bird lighting on a branch, and suddenly, Mickey Rooney, of course, how stupid of me. And you don't even know where the idea came from. Well, it's the guy in the basement. He finally found it. He put it in the pneumatic tube, and it came popping out into your head, and there it is. But I think it's the same phenomenon. You force it, you don't get it.
And we just, this is there all the time serving us.
Yeah.
And we should just be bowing down in gratitude
exactly.
all the time.
It's a terrific
service.
This
machine is operating behind our scenes. But I do think that we have to frame the question. We have to ask the question. Nothing's going to happen unless you ask the question. So most of what our concern should be is in framing the question.
And that is, in fact, the only role of what we loosely call the intellect. In my opinion, its sole purpose is to frame the question. And if we could teach people early on in their schooling that the analytical, verbal, you know, skill set that we all have to some degree or another is for framing questions, and it is not for answering them, then I think we'd be in a lot better shape. Because you think, gee, I don't understand it, I have to think about it more. And in fact, that's exactly the wrong thing to do. You think about it until the question is clear. When the question is clear, you have to let go of it, because the answer doesn't come from the question-making machine. It comes from intuition, which is silent. Intuition doesn't talk.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, I mean, as you were talking, and I was relating this to the whole thing of being an artist and things you have to help the students unlearn, one way this problem manifests is when we ask the question, who am I? And then immediately we start to define ourselves. I am a person who can't draw, or I am a whatever these definitions, wherever we've gotten them, whether thinking about ourselves or somebody else telling us things about ourselves, we block ourselves into boundaries that have nothing to do with who we really are. And in your job as an art teacher, this is a large part of what you're helping people unlearn, because that can be a huge prison that a person lives within, is just, I'm a bad artist, or I have no sense of color, or something like that.
And they don't even know that. They don't have any clue. They've identified themselves as that and named themselves and labeled. And they come in and they say, first thing everybody does is apologize for that they're going to be so bad. They've got themselves all set up so that they're not going to be rejected. It's going to be okay, because they've been set up in the past for this moment of rejection. You know, it's not going to work. And I mean, it's crazy. And so I have to like make it real cozy and comfy. And in this real cozy and comfy, see, I worry that a lot of the time, or I did at the beginning, I don't anymore, about what I was doing. I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing, but I couldn't do it any other way. So it came down to, if you want your kids, or if you want to study with me, you're going to just have to watch me do this thing, even if it feels like I'm wasting your money. Because I know that there were parents that wanted the kids to be able to draw the vase of flowers, because that's what their idea of why they were sending them there. And I was letting them doodle or do airplanes or guys at war or something, you know, because that's where the little boys, men's head was at. And so I can teach him how to shade a bomb. I can teach him, you know. And if I say, oh, this is negative, this is bad, we can't draw bombs, so I make them draw the vase of flowers, well, they'll be out of there in a week. Hmm. So to keep their attention and teach them not only how to draw, but what it is to perform action in life, we'll go with what's there. Hmm. So now I've lost my train of thought. Where do we start?
Well, just about unlearning the way we define ourselves.
So I create a very relaxed and easy atmosphere so that I can like feel what the student needs and help him ask the questions. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask the question is, how do I draw a head? Well, I can show, well, look, if we do this, that's the beginning to drawing a head. And then look. The eyes are actually halfway between the top of the head and the chin. Mm. Now you've learned something.
Yeah.
It's no more difficult than learning anything to learn how to draw. It's just so simple, these types of things, you know. Actually infusing that drawing with your deepest feelings, that's more difficult. So,
and that's what you're teaching by example rather than by explanation. Yeah. It's an effortless process based on a passion.
Well, and you had to conquer your own definition of yourself when you started out didn't define yourself as a teacher.
Right.
You know, so that was. Now I would like to go back to something we touched on earlier. And we were talking about before we even started recording the show, because it's very relevant to this thing of control versus spontaneity and all that, you were mentioning gardening. I know you want to do like a deeper show on gardening as an art form at some point, but let's talk about it in this context.
I'm glad this is the perfect moment to discuss at least an introduction to this.
Yeah.
Because gardening is one of the best ways to learn this skill. Because gardening is not all yours. You don't own it, and it's not your expression.
Yeah.
You cannot help but admit that God is doing this thing, that it's happening, and you become a co-creator in a natural process. And if we all felt that way about making art and everything we do, it would be a whole different thing. So
that's
a great,
beautiful.
It teaches you humility, it teaches you how to get out of the way and watch it happen and help it happen.
And give credit where credit is due.
That's right, exactly.
That's a really right. big part of it, you know.
You plant the seed, but you don't grow the tree.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to get across to students that we are one artist. And what each of us is doing is rediscovering how to do certain things. And we're holding this little act we did up and saying, look, I've discovered this again. Mm-hmm. And we're all the same being, discovering the same stuff again and again. And so for some reason, the universe likes to repeat itself again and again in this way.
With different flavors. Because it's like, you know, when you look at it, that's a beautiful way to look at it, because when you're looking at it in that unified way, you don't feel competitiveness in the same way that flowers don't. You know, like you can't imagine a violet saying, why am I not a rose? Or, you know, a fern saying, why am I not an oak tree? Because you go into a forest and you wouldn't want it to be like nothing but ferns or nothing but oak trees. It's just the whole realm is so rich because each aspect of creation is performing their little role. And if every artist were to recognize that my expression is just exactly that, my expression, and it has as much part in the whole forest of art as anybody else's expression, even if it's completely different, or even if it's just like the one.
Well, I love, I always try, well, let me put it this way. If a person loops back to where a previous aspect of themselves discovered something once before, such as Monet in Impressionism or something, somebody loops back and picks up on that place and sits in that place and says it again or says it in their own way, that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
This is how we move forward in this spiraling pattern. So it's just glorious, and I love it because this person has gone back, has become that person again, and is advancing it. And this is the way artists pick up from the past and move forward. Now, just copying the surface level of an impressionism is not the point.
Right.
It's showing that you like this thing, and you're going to make something that's in the manner of, and that, but it's very surface level. But this other thing, is this looping back, is just the flower.
It's asking the question again, like what Alan was saying, is that that you pose the question, and if we ask ourselves the same questions that Matisse, Picasso, Cezanne, and everybody ask themselves, we will come up with some different way of responding to that question. And
And he might have at that moment, Cezanne might have come up with that particular solution to the question at that moment. But see, since we are Cezanne, thinking it again, this is where we see ourselves as a garden.
Yeah.
And we're just blooming again and again, and in this eternal cycle. I mean, where is there any loss in this? And where is there anything but celebrating what it is?
I think that you should give some kind of a workshop on this exact thing has to do with not just painting and, you know, that, but creative
life itself.
People get
this no matter what.
Yeah.
But what I'm finding, and especially since I opened the doors on the new Icon space, the atmosphere and the receptivity of everyone around me is making it more possible for me to frame everything in this way. Mm-hmm. It's easier to talk about this, the essential meaning of art and meaning of life in the context of artistic expression. I'm very excited mm-hmm. about what's stirring in the atmosphere here right now.
Yeah, it definitely is something. And it's the timing of it, somehow this spring with the emergence of all of the leaves and the flowers and everything, the energy, I don't know whether it's just my own perception or whether it's a bigger phenomenon, but to me it feels like more is being born around here this spring than I've experienced in other springs. So.
Yes, it's the Ouroboros.
The what?
It's the myth of the eternal return. Every spring is the spring.
Uh-huh.
This is the only spring that has ever really been the spring. The other springs are just memories. But this is the real spring.
Ah, so this is a universal phenomenon that I am experiencing as a unique thing.
Experience of life taken in terms of the archetype instead of in terms of a long string of events like beads on a chain. Mm-hmm. It's what some scholars think it characterizes the mindset of prehistoric societies, cultures where the gods created this system, and you can see that it's a system, and the year was essentially the essence of what they created, and each year unfolded the same year. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you grow old during it and there is kind of linearity to it was not something they put their attention on very much. It was more the cyclical aspect of it than the linearity of it. And that's really, in a sense, what our experience is that every experience is happening for the first time. And you can't step into the same river twice. Mm-hmm. It's an old truism.
Heraclitus.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of Zen masters.
Yeah.
And my final gardening metaphor is that the fruit of your actions doesn't necessarily fall from the tree that you just planted.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.